Hello, my name is Steve Carlisle from Clearly Training, and I'm here today to talk to you about IFRS, that's International Financial Reporting Standards. I'm going to look at three areas. I'm going to look first of all at what do we mean by IFRS and what's the regulatory background to IFRS. Secondly, who uses IFRS in the UK? And thirdly, what recent changes have there been to IFRS? When we get to that last section, I'll tell you about four key changes that have taken place to IFRS recently. So, our first section, the regulatory background. And what do we mean by IFRS? That's International Financial Reporting Standards. And what do we mean by IAS? That's International Accounting Standards. What's the difference between the two? Well, it's just that the IAS, the International Accounting Standards, were the earlier ones that were published. They were then stopped, and then IFRS, International Financial Reporting Standards, were started. The IAS are numbered 1 to 41. The IFRS are numbered 1 currently to 8. Also with IFRS, there is an interpretation committee that exists to issue interpretation standards. And they help us understand what the international standards actually mean and how they apply to individual items. One final thing in International Accounting Standards, or IFRS, is that they have a conceptual framework. That's a background document that gives us details of all of the background issues and background definitions, such as what do we mean by an asset, what do we mean by a liability. It's the equivalent of what we have in the UK, and in the UK we call it the Statement of Principles. The IFRS and IAS usually allow a number of accounting treatments. What they will have is they'll have a benchmark treatment which says this is the way we would prefer you to do it, and then there may be one or even two alternatives. Now, just before the IFRS were introduced into the European Union, the International Accounting Standards Board undertook what they called an improvements project. And what they did was they improved the standards and they removed a lot of the choices that were there in the standards so that we could have one set of international standards. The year 2005 was very significant for IFRS, because that was the year that the European Union said listed groups, that's groups of companies whose shares were listed on EU stock exchanges, had to prepare IFRS compliant group accounts. So that was from the 1st of January 2005. So that was very significant. Prior to that, no companies in the EU had to produce IFRS. AIM companies, that's companies listed on the alternative investment market, they have to produce IFRS from the 1st of January 2007. So there was a two-year gap between fully listed groups and AIM groups having to use IFRS. What happened to UK GAAP then? Well, UK GAAP still exists. All other companies in the UK that aren't having to use IFRS could still use UK GAAP. And the UK Accounting Standards Board still exists to issue UK GAAP. So the legal position in the UK is that some organisations have to use International Financial Reporting Standards. Anybody else actually now has the option under the Companies Act 2006 of using international standards if they want to. So if you're the smallest company in the UK, you can, if you choose, use international standards. Most companies wouldn't, because the international standards are quite complex compared to the UK standards. But you do have the choice. At the start of the 21st century, when we were aware that international standards were being introduced into the UK for quoted groups, UK standards were altered quite significantly to bring them into line with international standards. So although prior to this, a huge gap had existed between international treatments and UK treatments, that gap has narrowed considerably. Some gaps, though, still do exist between UK standards and international standards. International standards also introduced lots of changes in terminology. So, for example, fixed assets became non-current assets, debtors, receivables, creditors became payables, stock became inventory. Even the profit and loss account changed its name and became the income statement. The balance sheet has recently had a change of name and is now called the Statement of Financial Position. And the Statement of Total Recognised Gains and Losses becomes the Statement of Recognised Income and Expenses. Now, those name changes are relevant for companies that use IFRS. I must emphasise, if you're still using UK standards, then you will still use the UK terminology. Okay, who has to use IFRS in the UK? Our second section. Does everybody have to use it? Well, as I've already outlined, the main changes took place in 2005. But since 2005, other organisations now have to comply with IFRS. So let's have a look at who they are. Here's the list. Number one, companies quoted on the UK Stock Exchange have to use IFRS and have had to do so since accounting periods beginning after January 2005. Companies quoted on the AIM, the alternative investment market, have had to use IFRS for accounting periods beginning after the 1st of January 2007. Public sector organisations are having to publish their first IFRS accounts for the year end 31st of March 2010. Now, that excludes local authorities. Local authorities have got another year's grace, so they have to produce IFRS accounts for their 31st of March 2011 year end. Finally, there are other organisations who have chosen to use IFRS voluntarily. For example, Bupa, a large organisation, not quoted, but it chooses to prepare its financial statements like all of the large UK quoted companies. And I've got to emphasise again, if you're not in that list, then you don't have to use IFRS. Okay, let's have a look at our final section. Some recent changes to IFRS. What's been happening in the world of international standards recently? Well, there's four key areas. First of all, presentation of financial statements. There's a change to international standard number one, relating to how we present our income statement in particular, our profit and loss account, if you like. Secondly, there's a change to interest capitalization rules. Thirdly, there's a change to segmental reporting. And fourthly, there's a change to group accounting. So let's have a look at the first one of those, the presentation of financial statements. This is International Accounting Standard 1, IAS 1. When does it apply from? Any period beginning after the 1st of January 2009. So any period beginning on or after the 1st of January 2009, this accounting standard is applicable. What does International Accounting Standard IAS 1 say? IAS 1 introduces the idea of a comprehensive income statement. So instead of having an income statement, or what we'd call in the UK a profit and loss account, on its own page of the accounts, instead of that, we would have a comprehensive statement of income. What would a comprehensive statement of income look like? Well, if you can imagine the profit and loss account, or income statement as it currently looks, starting with turnover and ending with profit after tax nowadays, and then bolted onto the bottom of that, the statement of total recognised gains and losses, or as they call it internationally, the statement of recognised income and expenditure, that is what the new statement could look like. So a comprehensive statement of income will have the income statement at the top and the statement of recognised income and expenses at the bottom, and it could be put together as one big statement. So you'd start off with turnover, you'd take off your operating expenses, you'd take off your taxation, and then after that, you'd have bolted on perhaps revaluation gains and losses, perhaps foreign exchange gains. And so that would give you your total comprehensive income for the year. Now, under the new standard, you do have a choice. You can still present this as two separate statements. So you can stick with an income statement at the top, which goes from turnover down to profit after tax, and then have a statement of recognised income and expenses as a separate document at the bottom. You can still do it that way. Or you can have it as one big statement. We'll have to see how companies actually use this. But it's interesting to note that the Americans also have the same model, and many companies do choose to have this one big statement of comprehensive income. That'll be quite confusing for the shareholders, but we'll have to wait and see how it works out in the UK, what companies actually decide to do with that. Okay, so that's that IAS 1. IFRS 8 next, segmental reporting. Segmental reporting is an issue for the largest companies in the UK and internationally. In the UK, we have a standard on segmental reporting which applies to large companies and quoted companies. Internationally, we have a segmental reporting standard that applies to companies that have quoted shares or quoted debt. And IFRS 8 represents a major change in segmental reporting. So what is that change? Well, segmental reporting is where the company reports how its different business segments have performed over the year. So when you look at an income statement, you see the total income in there. You see the total profit in there. When you look at the statement of position, that's the balance sheet, remember, you see the total assets and total liabilities. So what's segmental reporting about? Well, segmental reporting takes that turnover figure, that revenue figure, and splits it up between the different business segments. Segmental reporting can also show how other figures are broken down into the various business segments, like, for example, profit or assets. So let me give you a simple example. Let's say we had a company that sells both cars and motorbikes. And it sells the cars and motorbikes from its premises around the country. And each showroom sells both cars and motorcycles. Now, in its segmental report, the company should show, for example, the revenue from the car sales and the revenue from the motorbike sales separately. It should also show the profit from the car sales and the bike sales separately. But let's say the company is a little bit sensitive about its motorbike business because the motorbike business isn't doing very well. And it's also a little bit sensitive about its car business because actually the car business is doing extremely well. How can it manipulate these figures? The company might be thinking. Well, for example, they could do something completely incorrect and they could classify some of their car sales as bike sales. So the bike sales look higher and the car sales look lower. That would be verging on fraudulent. But what else could they do? Well, they could allocate the costs of the showroom differently. So let's say, for example, to make the bikes look more profitable, what they could do is they could allocate some of the overheads from the bike sales to the car sales so that the profit from the bike sales would go up and the profit from the car sales would go down. And this might present a better picture to those people using the accounts. Now, what IFRS 8 says is that what you present externally to your shareholders in your financial statements should be the same as the information that you're presenting internally to your chief operating decision maker. So the information that goes to the chief executive, the format that that's presented in, should be the same format that that's presented in to those external shareholders. You can't chop and change your information that you use internally so that it gives a better, a more acceptable picture to your external users. Now, that's quite concerning for companies. This standard applies from the 1st of January 2009 onwards. So the first time we'll see that this standard being used properly is for 31st December 2009 accounts for quoted companies. It will be very interesting to see exactly how this standard is used and exactly what level of detail companies use in reporting the different segments of those organisations. So it's quite a radical change. Basically, in a nutshell, what it's saying is the way you report internally to your chief operating decision maker, that is the segmental disclosure that will be made in your financial statements. Okay, International Accounting Standard 23. So this is IAS 23, and this is a revision of an existing standard. And the standard is on capitalized borrowing costs. Capitalized borrowing costs. So what scenario does IAS 23 deal with? Let me give you an example. Let's say that you were having a new head office being built for you. So you had a building contractor in and they were building a new head office. And let's say, for simplicity, this project was going to take a full year. You started at the beginning of your financial year and the project would end at the end of your financial year. So all the way through that first year, you can't actually use that building. It's providing no economic return to you whatsoever because it's still being built. Okay. And let's say that we borrowed an average amount over the year of £1 million to build that building. So we borrowed £1 million, and let's say again, keeping it simple, that the interest rate is 10%. So over the year, we have incurred an interest cost of £100,000. That's 10% of £1 million. Now, what would we normally do with that interest? I say normally, I mean, under UK standards, what would have normally happened with that interest? Well, we would have simply debited the profit and loss account and credited cash. That would be our accounting entry. Very simple. And that's counted as an expense during the year. What does IS-23 say? Well, IS-23 originally said you have a choice as to how you treat that £100,000 worth of interest. Number one, you can do what I just said. You can treat it as an expense, nice and simple, put it through the profit and loss account, or the income statement, as they call it internationally. Or alternatively, in the same way as paying for the builders and the joiners and all the other people who work on the project is a cost of that asset, so is the interest. So the second way of dealing with that interest is to credit cash, same as before, but your debit goes to the non-current asset, the fixed asset, the cost of the building. And it's capitalised effectively. And of course, what that will mean is that the cost of the building will be £100,000 higher, and therefore the depreciation will be slightly higher over the useful life of that asset. So you can capitalise the interest. That's what the old standard says. Now, what the new standard says, the new version of the standard, which is mandatory from 2009, that says that in fact there's only one way now of treating that interest, and that is to capitalise it. That's the more complex treatment. So what you would do with that interest now, if you're following international standards, is to credit cash but debit the non-current asset. Capitalise the interest. Okay. And the interesting thing, you might find it interesting, you might not, but the interesting thing about this is even if you haven't borrowed any money to build that asset, you should still capitalise the notional interest. Just think about it. If you borrow money, yeah, you've got £1 million loan. But what if you didn't borrow the money? You'd have had to get it from somewhere. You'd have had to perhaps take it from your existing cash resources, which you could alternatively have invested in the business. And so there is a cost of using that money. So even if you haven't borrowed the money, there is still a notional interest cost. Let's say that the same company that had an average of £1 million invested in that project over the year could earn a return of 12% in its normal business. What we would say is that it has a cost of capital of 12%. So the interest cost, the notional interest cost of using that money, is this time 12% of £1,120,000. And so we can capitalise that. We wouldn't credit cash this time, we'd credit interest, and we would debit again the non-current asset, the fixed asset. So that's IAS 23. Rather unusual. It gives us one treatment for interest, and that's to capitalise it from 2009 onwards. By the way, once the building is finished and being used by the organisation, you can no longer capitalise any interest from that date, even if you've still got a loan outstanding. So the interest is capitalised while an asset is being constructed, when it's not, in other words, being used by the organisation. Just out of interest, if you're interested in these things, we're simply copying what the Americans do under the American standards with this one. Okay, our last set of changes is to groups, group accounting. And we actually have two standards here that have changed. First of all, we have an IAS, IAS 27, that has been revised. And secondly, we have an IFRS, IFRS 3, that has also been revised. So let's do them, and we'll deal with IAS 27 first. IAS 27 is called transactions with non-controlling interest. So IAS 27 is all about what we'd call the minority interest. This standard deals with two situations. First of all, what happens when you increase your shareholding? So where you already have a subsidiary holding, let's say you have 60%, and you decide to go from 60% to 80%. How do we deal with that? And secondly, going the other way, what happens when we reduce our shareholding? So where we have a subsidiary before of, let's say, 100%, and we reduce it down to, let's say, 80%. So where we sell a little bit, but we've still retained a subsidiary after. How do we account for those two situations? By the way, this standard applies for periods beginning after the 1st of July 2009. So it won't affect most companies that have a calendar year end until the 31st of December 2010. So how do we deal with those transactions, and why have they changed? What are the changes here? What's the background to the changes? Well, the changes revolve around a change of approach towards the minority interest. How we perceive the minority interest has changed. We used to use the approach called the parent entity method, where basically the minority interest was seen as outsiders to the group. Now, we've changed in this standard, and by the way, in IFRS 3 revised, to what we call the economic entity method, where we see the minority interest as an integral class of shareholders to the group. So the minority interest shareholders are just other shareholders over and above the parent company shareholders. What are the practical impacts of that, though? Well, I'll give you both of them. First of all, on acquisitions. When you have a subsidiary, so I'm going to give you an example. Let's say we have a 70% owned subsidiary. So it's a subsidiary already, and our minority interest would therefore be 30%. 70% the group owns, 30% the minority. If we then decided to go from 70% to 90%, so if we decided to acquire another 20% of the shares, we would be buying those shares off the minority. All that would be happening is the minority would be going down from a 30% minority to a 10% minority. Let's say we bought those shares for £5 million and the assets that we'd acquired had a book value of £4 million. Now, in the old days, before this standard was changed, we would have said we'd paid £5 million, we'd bought assets of £4 million and we'd bought goodwill of £1 million. And it's that last bit that's changed. We can't create goodwill by buying from our internal shareholders, because remember, the minority are being treated here as if they're an integral part of the shareholding of the group. So what we do with that million, instead of showing it as goodwill, we put it through our reserves as an adjustment to reserves. So we would debit it to reserves. So the full double entry there would be debit minority interest, £4 million, debit equity or reserves, £1 million, and credit cash, £5 million. Okay, that's one on acquisitions. What about on disposals? Let's say we owned 100% of the shares of a company, so we had no minority interest. And then we decided that we wanted to sell 20% of our shares. So what would happen is the minority interest of 20% would be created. Let's say we sold the shares for 10 million and the assets were worth only 8 million. Now, in the old days, we would have said we'd made a profit on sale of 2 million. Sold it for 10, assets only really worth 8. 2 million profit. But because of our new approach and our new conceptual way of seeing the minority interest, we can't make a profit by selling within the group of shareholders. So that 2 million can't be disclosed as a profit in our income statement. So what do we do with it? Well, we put it to reserves. So the double entry would be debit cash, 10 million, that's the full value of the sale, credit the minority interest, 8 million. And credit the 2 million to reserves. So that's IAS 27. It changes the way we deal with acquisitions and disposals of shares to the minority interest. It deals with situations where we go from a big subsidiary to a smaller subsidiary, or a small subsidiary to a bigger subsidiary. And the changes are as a result of the change in conceptual approach to what the minority interest is. We used to treat the minority as outsiders, and we now effectively treat them as insiders of the group. Okay, the last standard to look at is IFRS 3. IFRS 3 previously existed and it's now been revised. And it applies from periods beginning after July 2009, the same as IAS 27. So most companies won't be affected by this until 2010 year ends. What does IFRS 3 change? Well, it has a number of changes within it. The key one is the change to the way that we deal with goodwill. So let's have a look at a practical example of the impacts of the change to how we deal with goodwill. I'm going to give you a simple example now of the impact of the changes. Let's say that Company A bought 80% of the shares of Company B. And let's say that Company A paid 10 million. And let's say that 80% of the assets of Company B were worth 8 million. So our goodwill would be a cost of 10 million, our share of the assets, 8 million, therefore goodwill, 2 million. 10 less 8 is 2 million. Now, the thing is, what we have there with that 2 million is 80% of Company B's goodwill. Think about it. 10 million we paid, we've bought 80% of the shares. So that's 80% of the cost of B is 10 million. The assets we've acquired are 80% of the assets of B. That 8 million is 80% of B's assets. So the goodwill must be 80% of B's goodwill. When you think about it, when we do the consolidation for Company B, what we consolidate is Company A's assets plus 100% of Company B's assets, because we control Company B. We don't just consolidate 80% of their assets, we consolidate all of them. The same with the liabilities. We take Company A's liabilities plus 100% of Company B's liabilities and consolidate all of them. Yeah. There's only one item in Company B's accounts that we don't consolidate 100% of, and that's Company B's goodwill. We only historically ever took our share of Company B's goodwill and put it in the group accounts. So what this standard says is, and it does give you a choice, it says either you can do things as we've always done them and simply put the 2 million in as the goodwill, or you can work out what 100% of the goodwill in Company B would be. How would we work out 100% of the goodwill? Well, the standard does have a formula in there for working it out. I'll run through it with you briefly. You would take the consideration that you've paid for your 80% share plus any consideration you'd paid for any previous holdings you had, plus the value of the remaining minority holding, and you would compare that against the fair value of all of Company B's assets, and that would give you 100% of the goodwill. Let's say, in my example, we already know that 80% of B's goodwill is 2 million. Let's say that 100% of B's goodwill was 2.5 million, using that formula. So we can either put 2 million in as goodwill, or we can gross that up, add 500,000 to the goodwill figure, and we'd add 500,000 to the minority interest figure, and we could show it that way. We have a choice. And again, this ties in, like a lot of the things I've been talking about today, with what the Americans do. The only difference is the Americans don't give you a choice. You have to use 100% goodwill under their standards. Okay, so that's IFRS 3. And again, that's going to really come into force for companies using IFRS next year. And that concludes our roundup of IFRS. We've had a look at what we mean by IFRS and IAS, what the ideas actually mean. We've had a look at who has to use IFRS, and there have been some major changes for the public sector and local authorities over the next couple of years. And we've had a look at some of the recent IFRS standards. There still exist a number of differences between IFRS and UK standards. And if you want any more information on those changes, you can attend one of the regularly held AAT sessions on IFRS update, where we will run you through the differences and similarities between IFRS and UK standards. Thanks very much for listening. My name is Steve Carlisle. Bye-bye.